It is the Chris and Amy show. Brad Young sitting in for Chris Ranji. And normally at this time, we chat with Major Garrett, CBS Chief Washington correspondent, but he is out on assignment. So we've got the ever faithful and true, the excellent Andrew Egger, White House correspondent for The Bulwark. Andrew, thank you for coming in clutch today.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. Major does some real work every now and then, but I'm always happy to come on and chat. I'm usually free around this time.
Well, and we're not just using you as a fill-in. We like having you on anyway, so just so you know.
Well,
you're also coming on, I have to say, at a very, it's a tumultuous time because we just had a very heated discussion about Bruce Springsteen being overrated or not. So you are coming in and the listeners are heated at the moment. So fair warning.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, we'll smooth things over. We'll talk everybody down.
Let's start with some breaking news, at least this morning, that the former Federal Reserve Governor, Lisa Cook, who was fired by President Donald Trump, has filed a lawsuit against the president. What do we know about this?
Yeah, so this is the latest kind of clash between Donald Trump and the Federal Reserve, which he has chafed at for a long time over his inability to kind of like more directly set monetary policy. This is sort of a subset of that, but it's also its own separate thing because the president has said that he is firing her essentially due to some alleged misconduct about a mortgage application, which is a thing he's reached for a couple of his political opponents. He's made a similar case about, for instance, Senator Adam Schiff. But essentially what the governor is saying, what Mrs. Cook is saying is that this is not an adequate for cause firing. And she's pushing back in particular on the question of whether the president has sort of overstepped his authority in directing essentially like mortgage fraud authorities in the federal government, the regulators at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to look unduly into people who are already his political opponents. She's basically saying, you know, this is not stuff that the president is stumbling across. This is kind of a fishing expedition to find things that he can then use to hang charges on people who are kind of in his way politically. And again, this is not, when I say hang charges, she has not been charged with a crime or anything, but there's been this misconduct alleged, essentially. So that's where we are right now in terms of what the president's alleging and what she's pushing back with in this lawsuit.
Yeah, Andrew, Brad Young here. And under the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, as you've already kind of mentioned about having a for-cause firing, typically, if you look at case law and how that has been interpreted over the years, for-cause means that at trial, in order to defend against this, Trump would have to prove that the Fed governor actually did commit mortgage fraud, and that was the basis for a termination. But we haven't really seen any actual evidence of this, have we? I mean, the only thing that I've seen in being reported is this allegation of mortgage fraud, but we haven't seen any evidence of it, have we?
Yeah, and I am certainly not like a mortgage fraud expert. My understanding of this is that it's a pretty thin rod. Essentially, what they're alleging is that you know, this is a person who, like many top officials in D.C., owns a home where they're from and owns a home in the D.C. area where they're working right now, and that on their mortgage applications to get loans for both of those homes, they essentially treated both of them as though they were primary residences, which is, you know, in theory where you live, supposed to be where you live 50% of the time plus one day or whatever. From what I have been told, this is not a particularly uncommon kind of thing that people do to fudge, they're like, oh, you know, I'm splitting my time between these two places and I'm going to just fill them both out as primary residences. I have also been told, again, I'm not an expert on this, you're not really supposed to do that, right? It's like, you know, it's just sort of like this thing that people have done, which is maybe cutting a corner on the law. Whether it implicates her job performance at the Fed or implicates it, you know, Senator Adam Schiff's job performance as a senator is another question, right? As well as, is this a thing that would actually be like pursued as criminal under other circumstances? And I think the answer there is often not.
Yeah, and if you look at the case law and how this has been litigated over the years, typically it requires the person to commit something related to their job as being the for cause for termination. I haven't heard of any allegations of any sort of cause that would be subject to termination regarding the Fed governor's actual job duties. It's all focused on this personal mortgage situation, correct?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And that kind of shows just how far off the map we are with a lot of this stuff, because, I mean, the original reason that the president was trying to fire a lot of people, not in this case, but you know, across the federal government in a lot of these roles where people can just be fired for cause by law. I mean, the law says there has to be a cause. The president can't just unilaterally terminate them. Originally, the president was essentially trying to say that shouldn't bind me. I'm going to try to just do it anyway. And that got very quickly tied up in the courts, right? Like, so he kind of got brushed back on his original plan of just saying I shouldn't be bound by these sorts of regulations. These are essentially unconstitutional. I'm the executive. I should be able to decide who works for the executive and the executive branch. So now that there has been kind of that play has gotten snarled up, they're moving to sort of like the next thing over, which is, okay, let's find a cause. Let's say there's been some misconduct here. There's been some kind of issue. And as you say, in this case and in many other cases, that has very little to do with the actual job performance. It's a little bit comparable, although even further afield than the allegations they've made about Jerome Powell himself, the chair of the Federal Reserve, where you've kind of seen them in recent weeks start to spin up this allegation that he had mismanaged, you know, the renovation of the Fed headquarters in D.C. and, you know, gone over budget on that. And like that might in theory be a cause to eventually terminate him. So you kind of see them again. Plainly, the actual goal here is to exert more personal control over the rate policies of the Federal Reserve, and they are kind of grabbing any tool to hand to do that.
Yes, because let's say there were an issue, and the fraud issue or whatever it may be with the governor of the Federal Reserve. Well, the Federal Reserve is legally an independent agency, but if there needs to be some oversight, isn't that the oversight supposed to be Congress, not the president?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little of both, right? Because, I mean, a lot of these statutory protections that are in place for these jobs are a matter of law, right? The Congress has put them in place. The president's people would argue that maybe they shouldn't have put those in place. Maybe those are you know, an unconstitutional overreach on Congress's part by you know, limiting the president's ability to fire people in these sort of semi-autonomous parts of the executive branch. And obviously, that gets into much deeper constitutional questions about whether the Constitution should permit, you know, parts of the executive to be beyond the reach of the executive. There are smart lawyers on both sides of that question. There are smart lawyers on the president's side who essentially say it's crazy to have a setup where you know, there are people who in theory work for the president, but the president does not have this sort of personnel authority over him. And then there are other people who say this system's worked pretty well. You know, it's allowed us to have these independent agencies that are free, largely free of kind of like political meddling and influence, and that's a good system, and that's the way Congress set it up. So that's all kind of in the background of this conversation, that sort of legal question over against even just the political one that we're talking about as well.
We're talking to Andrew Egger. He's the White House correspondent for the Bulwark. And Andrew, much has been made about President Trump's so-called takeover of Washington, D.C. There's been a lot of press reporting about how their government officials are upset about it. The city doesn't like it. The city officials don't like it. But let's look at the underlying issue. Do we have any data, or do you have any anecdotal or even personal experience about whether the crime situation has gotten better since the deployment of federal troops and the FBI in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, so we actually did see a little bit of data on this. I believe just this morning it was announced that in the time since this crackdown has been put into place, violent crime in the city is down, according to the data I saw this morning, 58%, you know, across about a week and a half. So that's preliminary, but it's real. It's a real, you know, it's obviously a quite significant dip. And I think the question is, what do you attribute that to, right? I mean, obviously, you know, more cops in the streets are going to result in less obvious out-and-out crime in the streets, just sort of for obvious reasons. So the question is, what percentage of that dip is just we're doing more policing now, there's a greater show of force, so people are more scared to commit crimes, and what percentage of it is permanent versus just like, wow, okay, I maybe I was going to commit a crime before, but like now it's like I need to wait and see what's going on here. You know what I mean? Like how depressed it will remain versus whether any of this is sort of like a temporary drop. There's part of it is also that there has just been a temporary drop in like being outside in DC, right? I mean, like everybody has kind of gone to ground, not just the criminals, right? People are a little freaked out about like just sort of the, you know, these federal troops, these people in kind of like unmarked uniforms and masks and things like that. It has created an issue for things like restaurant traffic in the city. So there are all these kind of other things that you know, some city residents are concerned about as well. But when it comes to the question of has it reduced crime, I think at least the preliminary answer to that is definitely yes, it has.
Andrew, the White House has said that it has fired the director of the CDC, Susan Monterez, and she has been removed from her job also because of some of the policies of RFK Jr. Three senior CDC leaders submitted their resignations yesterday. That's according to emails from the Wall Street Journal. What do you make of the chaos right now at the CDC, or is it chaos?
Yeah, this is going to be a huge sort of personnel legal headache for a lot of the same reasons that the Fed Governor Lisa Cook, who we were just talking about, is. I mean, a lot of these same questions are implicated there. Just to go a little bit broader to the question of what's going on at the CDC in terms of policy, I mean, I think what we are seeing is more and more sort of career CDC employees who maybe originally were sort of staying on in the hope that, you know, RFK Jr. coming in atop Health and Human Services as secretary of that agency was not going to be, you know, as disruptive as it has proven to be. I think maybe they knew that he had a long history as like a critic of HHS and CDC and just public health in America in general, a longtime critic of vaccines and you know, America's vaccine agenda, or not agenda, vaccine apparatus. But he had made a lot of noises during his confirmation hearings, like he was going to not necessarily govern that way, right? He wasn't going to meddle with various vaccine advisory committees. He wasn't going to meddle with the vaccine schedule that children receive at their, you know, regular pediatric appointments, all that kind of stuff. And since he has come in, he has thrown all that out, right? I mean, he's been very, very disruptive in terms of all kinds of public health policy, especially around vaccines. This particular story is so strange because this is the person who just got in there, right? I mean, the current director of the CDC has only been in that job for about a month, and came in under the RFK apparatus. So I don't know if there's like, you know, I don't think any of us know whether there are, you know, personnel things under the surface or, you know, like particular disagreements. But the bottom line for, you know, this sort of rash of resignations that we are seeing is, wow, this guy is actually kind of like setting out to chop down a lot of the U.S. sort of vaccine set up with like an axe, like, or a blunter instrument than that, and we're not going to be a party to that.
Well, one more question on that CDC issue, Andrew, and that's this. Didn't the CDC come out with some changes about COVID-19 vaccinations just this week? And couldn't that impact how people have access to COVID-19 vaccines going forward?
Yeah, so this has been, this story has been kind of a death of a thousand cuts. The RFK Jr. has taken a number of different swings at the COVID vaccines. He has removed the recommendation that many types of, first the recommendation that all healthy adults get them, that's been gone. He took them off the childhood vaccine schedule, so that's you know, gone. This week it's been reported that he has contemplated, you know, yanking the FDA authorization for them altogether. And then the other big story that we've been looking at with regard to RFK and vaccines this week has not just been about the COVID vaccines, but it's been about him potentially changing the U.S. Regulation system around liability for vaccine injury, which is, you know, he has long had an axe to grind over the fact that individual people who have side effects after receiving a vaccine aren't able to sue vaccine manufacturers over that. That dates back to a law that was passed in the 80s to basically just keep vaccine companies from going out of business over, you know, punitive lawsuits over very, very rare vaccine injuries. So he would like to, you know, reopen all of that up, and that would have effects massively beyond just the COVID vaccine, because the thing about vaccines is they're not particularly profitable for pharma companies, right? They're pretty low margin items. You get them once or twice when you're a kid, as compared to something like a pill you take all your life, right? Those are the things that actually make these companies money. So the fact that these companies, you know, produce vaccines is in part just because we really need them, right? I mean, like, and policymakers have gone out of their way to ensure that it's not in an environment where these become higher risk than higher reward for these companies over the years. And so that is a thing that a lot of public health people are very concerned about. If it became far easier to, again, sue these companies for these very rare sorts of side effects that are rare, but they do happen. Then it could be, you could get into a case where even the vaccines that remain on the schedule are no longer available because companies won't think the juice is worth the squeeze to make them.
Andrew Egger, White House correspondent for The Bulwark, helping to bring some serenity to the conversation by talking about Washington, D.C. over Bruce Springsteen. We really appreciate you. Thanks so much. And for our listeners, Andrew Egger, fellow 314.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. I'm pro-Bruce.
He's pro-Bruce and a fellow St. Louisan. We appreciate you, Andrew. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.